highs 65 to 70 degrees, and Wednesday sunny with highs in the upper 40s.
He wants 4 more years of chaos. 4 more years of the blame game.
We travel to North Carolina, a key state on the path to victory for either Vice President Harris or former President Trump.
For Monday, October 21st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Former President Trump has suggested that he will exact vengeance on news outlets that anger him.
Press advocates say he's fueled a climate hostile to journalism.
It speaks directly to the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is a cornerstone of our democracy.
Later, high-quality preschool can make a big difference for kids.
But many Head Start teachers often live in poverty themselves.
The Biden administration wants to raise their pay, but it's not clear who will fund it.
I'm paycheck to paycheck. I had to take out a loan for the summer. Pretty much budget myself so I can get through the summer, but things happen.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are crisscrossing the key swing states with about 2 weeks to go before Election Day. Both candidates have spent the last week trying to sharpen their pitches to voters, especially those who still remain undecided. NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports their campaign moves say something about their strategies in the final stretch to November 5th.
Vice President Kamala Harris was in Georgia over the weekend courting black voters. Now she's hitting all three of the blue wall states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in a single day. She'll be back in Georgia later this week for a rally with former President Barack Obama. Donald Trump, meanwhile, was in Pennsylvania over the weekend, is in North Carolina, and will be in Nevada later in the week. It all speaks to the desperation for both candidates to turn out their voters in the final days of this campaign. For Harris, the blue wall is critical to her chances of winning. For Trump, he's hoping to pick off Pennsylvania and insulate himself in the Sunbelt states. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
The White House says President Biden is deeply concerned about the release of classified documents on Israel's plans for a potential retaliatory attack against Iran. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the administration continues to investigate the unauthorized release of the material.
We're not exactly sure how these documents found their way into the public domain. I know the Department of Defense is investigating this. And I'm sure that as they work through that, they'll try to determine the manner in which they did become public.
The Biden administration says it's investigating whether the documents were leaked or hacked. The city of Akron, Ohio, has agreed to pay nearly $5 million in a settlement with the family of Jaylen Walker, the 25-year-old black man shot and killed by police in 2022. Anna Hudson of IdeaStream Public Media reports Walker's death sparked major protests and calls for police reform.
Officers shot Walker at least 46 times after a car and foot chase. Police say Walker fired a gun during the pursuit, but was unarmed when he was killed. Akron Mayor Shamas Malik says reform is needed in the city's police department.
We need systemic changes to our policing system to improve policy, practices, training, and culture, to ensure that we do everything we can to avoid tragic incidents.
Malik says he plans to seek expertise from the U.S. Department of Justice to help review the department's use of force policies. Last year, a grand jury declined to indict the 8 officers who fatally shot Walker. For NPR News, I'm Anna Huntsman in Akron, Ohio.
This is NPR News from Washington. Thousands of mental health care professionals at Kaiser Permanente are on strike. The union members are demanding better wages and restoration of the union's pension plan that was taken away. They're also protesting increased workloads. Their contract expired 3 weeks ago. Psychologists, therapists, and other mental health workers are vowing to remain off the job until their demands are met. The UN Biodiversity Conference is taking place this week in Colombia, one of the world's most biodiverse nations. Reporter John Otis says a huge variety of animals are on display in a new version of the country's national anthem.
Colombia's national anthem is ponderous and hard to sing, but a new version has been released that's sung mostly by birds. Bogota composer Miguel de Narvaez produced the song.
There are 41 birds, 3 frogs, the jaguar, and the whales. It was a real challenge because birds or animals are not pitched to sing in a specific tune or something.
He says the retooled anthem can help call attention to vanishing habitats and the nearly 1 million species around the world facing extinction. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
Stocks traded mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 344 points at the close. The Nasdaq up 50 points. The S&P fell 10. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantsFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. And we are in our Come Home to KAXE membership drive, so now's your chance to become a member of the KAXE family. And you can do that by donating now at KAXE.org. And don't forget our KAXE question of the week. What food reminds you of home? Text us at 218-326-1234.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Raleigh, North Carolina, one of the battleground states that has been getting a lot of attention this year. We will be reporting here all week because North Carolina has become a major focal point for both presidential campaigns. Millions and millions of dollars are being spent, rallies are being organized, and the polls show a race that is essentially tied. There are also a lot of factors that make the race hard to predict, including damage from Hurricane Helene, and also some far-right down-ballot candidates that are really hanging over the other races on the ballot as well. Joining us to talk about this is Colin Campbell, Capital Bureau Chief at member station WUNC. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Scott.
So let's start with this. Barack Obama won North Carolina in 2008, and ever since then, Democrats have been trying to win it and coming up short. Why does the party think they have a shot in North Carolina this year?
Well, in short, we've got lots of in-migration here. North Carolina's urban areas are some of the fastest growing in the country, and a lot of that is younger, college-educated people who tend to vote for Democrats. Places like Charlotte and Raleigh seem to get more blue with every single election cycle, but those gains for Democrats have, at least so far, been offset by losses in some of the more rural parts of the state where Democrats want to sort of change that trend.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden lost here by just about one percentage point back in 2020, and ever since Biden dropped out of the race, Harris and Trump have been pretty much tied in most polls, or it's certainly well within the margin of error, even when Trump seems to be a little bit ahead.
What does all of this look like on the ground in North Carolina?
Well, we've seen visits from the candidates and their surrogates nearly every week. It's almost lost track of who's here what day. It's mostly focused on the urban areas. Trump has multiple stops this week in the state. Former President Bill Clinton just wrapped up a bus tour. Here he is talking about former President Trump.
He wants 4 more years of chaos, 4 more years of the blame game. We want a leader who will take us to buckle down.
So Clinton was out in the eastern side of the state, but out in western North Carolina in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, election officials have been scrambling to move some polling places, add some flexibility into the absentee ballot rules aimed at helping voters who still might be displaced from their homes due to flooding. Voters from those affected counties are going to have the option to return their absentee ballots to election offices anywhere in the state up until the polls close on election night.
And there's been a lot of speculation and conversation about the fact that that's a heavily Trump part of the state and whether those folks would be able to get their votes in time. Let's just talk about Trump in North Carolina for a moment. Why is North Carolina in particular so important for Trump to win if he wants to return to the White House?
Well, with 16 electoral votes here, North Carolina has more than other swing states aside from Pennsylvania and Georgia. If he lost here, he'd have to win most of the other swing states, including some of the so-called blue wall states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And that seems like a really long shot scenario for Trump.
We're focusing on the presidential race, but there's a lot of other races on the ballot in North Carolina, and the gubernatorial race especially has gotten a lot of national attention. Walk us through how some of the other races on the ballot are causing some concerns for Republicans at this point.
Yeah, the Republican candidate for governor, Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, is trailing really far in the polls, has lost support from many of his fellow Republicans after a CNN report last month that said he'd posted pro-slavery Nazi comments on a porn website. He's since filed a defamation lawsuit challenging the report as false. Republicans are also running a candidate for state school superintendent who's made some social media posts calling for the execution of Barack Obama and other Democrats. So there's a worry all of that might damage turnout among some of the more moderate Republican voters that just may not like any of these candidates.
Yeah. What are some of the other issues that are likely to play a role in the state?
Abortion's big here. The Republican-led legislature passed a 12-week abortion ban with some exceptions last year. Democrats are concerned that wins for GOP candidates in this year's election might mean a more restrictive ban might be on the table here next year. Meanwhile, immigration, lots of Republican candidates here are also talking about that. Even though North Carolina's thousands of miles from the border, there's a ballot question about that, amending the state constitution to ban non-citizen voting. It's already illegal, but that's seen as sort of a turnout driver to energize some Republican voters.
Colin Campbell covers politics in North Carolina for member station WUNC. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
And we're going to have more coverage from this key swing state throughout the week as our series, We the Voters, continues.
The preschool teachers we rely on to help our most vulnerable children growing up in poverty get paid so little, they often live in poverty themselves. Now the Biden administration wants to change that by raising pay for teachers in the federal Head Start program. The only problem is, it's not clear who will pay for it. NPR's Corey Turner explains.
This story is unfolding in big cities and small towns all over the U.S. Places like Pullman, Michigan, a blink-and-you'll-miss-it town about an hour south of Grand Rapids. If you drive past the VFW and the tiny post office, you'll find Julie Beck's Head Start preschool classroom.
A rainbow goes up and down. Can you go up and down?
Miss Julie, as she's known, is the room's lead teacher and sits at a blueberry blue table. She's helping a little girl draw a rainbow with crayons as thick as the child's little fingers.
You do it too? And down. There you go.
On the playground, Miss Julie says Head Start's focus on play-based learning helps children pick up not just their ABCs, but also vital social skills.
We teach them so much. It's fun, though. The kids don't know they're learning.
Head Start began in 1965, and it provides high-quality preschool, nutritious meals, and wraparound support for children and families in poverty. Research shows poverty can create early learning gaps for kids that can last a lifetime. But high-quality preschool can help prevent and even close those gaps. The problem is, Miss Julie makes $20 an hour, working about 10 months a year.
I'm paycheck to paycheck. I had to take out a loan for the summer, so I'm about one car payment behind.
Nationally, nearly one in five Head Start teachers quit last year, in part because of low pay. So the Biden administration recently released a new rule meant to push Head Start programs across the country to raise teacher pay.
I think it's incredible because now we would be paying them somewhat near what they're worth.
Sarah C. runs the Head Start programs in Pullman and the rest of Allegan County, Michigan. And she estimates she may have to raise pay by as much as $10,000 per person. There's just one problem, C. says. The rule requires this, but it doesn't help pay for it.
Not having designated funds to carry out that new rule would cause us to have to lower the amount of kids that we serve.
C has already raised local Head Start wages, in part by eliminating 40 slots for children. She says the decision made her physically sick, even as the pandemic had driven down demand. Now, though, demand is back up.
We are filling the classrooms and we are building wait lists.
Even after that pay raise a few years ago, longtime teacher assistant Norma Silva, who works in Miss Julie's classroom, still makes just over $16 an hour.
I start as a Head Start parent.
When I ask, what's it like living on $16 an hour?
It's just hard.
But you keep coming back.
You've done
it 24 years.
I do. Yes.
Okay, so tell me why.
The kids will bring me joy. I like working with kids.
This is a common refrain. Head Start teachers who stay often do so because they know the difference it can make for children living in poverty. As the Pullman Head Start teachers stand together on the playground, I ask, what would a big, lasting pay raise mean to you? Miss Julie thinks of her son.
My son's in the Marines. When he re-enlisted, he got a bigger chunk.
A re-enlistment bonus, which he then gave to his mom. Suddenly, her eyes well up.
I'm trying not to get teared up. My son paid for my house. So that's why I can make it as a teacher.
Unless Congress follows the Biden administration's lead and agrees to increase Head Start funding, a pay raise will force many Head Start programs to make an impossible choice.
One more minute, my friends.
Between making sure all children who need a Head Start get one and making sure their teachers can afford to stay. Corey Turner, NPR News, Pullman, Michigan.
The Biden administration wants health insurance to cover all over-the-counter contraception. That includes the new birth control pill available without a prescription, as well as condoms and Plan B. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin reports.
Under the Affordable Care Act, women have been able to get birth control pills for $0 at the pharmacy counter using their health insurance. But that means they've needed to have a prescription from a doctor. Now that the Food and Drug Administration has approved a pill that does not require a prescription, called O-Pill, the Biden administration wants health insurance to cover that too. The administration is proposing a new rule under the Affordable Care Act, requiring health insurance to provide access to over-the-counter contraception for women without a copay. That would include O-Pill, as well as Plan B and condoms. Here's what Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said when he announced the proposal.
This proposed rule will build on the progress we have already made under the Affordable Care Act to help ensure that more women can access the contraceptive services they need without out-of-pocket costs.
He says services that prevent pregnancy are more important than ever since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Lori Sobel is the director of women's health policy at the nonprofit think tank KFF. She says a few states have tried to cover over-the-counter contraception like this, but getting the word out was tricky and people haven't always taken advantage of it.
By doing something at the federal level that requires all private health insurance plans to cover over-the-counter contraception without cost sharing, it makes it much easier to message to people and to inform people that this is part of their coverage.
However, she points out that it seems as though only women can buy condoms using their health insurance without a copay under this proposed rule. Still, it's a big deal, she says.
It's definitely a step. It's huge. Condoms have never been covered before.
The details are still coming into focus. Women could need to buy the products and then get reimbursed, but more likely they would pick them up in the aisles and buy them at the pharmacy counter, which is typically equipped to handle health insurance. The proposed rule, if it goes through, would likely not take effect until at least 2025, and a new Congress could undo it. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Home is where you can kick off your shoes, pat the dog, and settle in with the music and voices you rely on. If KXE is the soundtrack of your home, we need you to become a member now. Membership is our largest single source of support, and it's so easy to become a member. Grab your phone and dial 218-326-1234 to become a member now. Listen to the Wednesday morning show to hear area voices with me, Andrew DeZingle, our look at local arts in Minnesota. This week, I'll be talking with three of the founding members of Podipto and also with artist Carrie Katzenmeyer. That'll be this Wednesday. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. Online at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Kellyer Student Council is putting on a costume 5K run and walk Saturday, October 26th, with registration at 8:30 a.m. and the 5K starting at 9. We receive support from the Veteran Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211. It provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to veterans and veteran service member families who are in crisis. Trained veteran providers are available to serve fellow veterans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. And KXE has a mission to build community throughout northern Minnesota. Our loyal audience supports the community organizations that support KAXE. Consider joining us in building community in northern Minnesota. Learn more, email sponsor at kaxe.org. Thank you. An MS support group meets at the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids on the second Thursday of each month from 11 to 12:30.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie, Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters on Friday, November 1st. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Biden administration's top diplomat is heading back to the Middle East at another critical juncture. Israeli forces killed the Hamas leader in Gaza last week, and they've been pressing their offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon, too. Israel is also poised to strike Iran in response to a massive Iranian missile attack earlier this month. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports that the U.S. has been trying to prevent the kind of regional war that this is rapidly becoming.
This will be Secretary of State Antony Blinken's first visit to Israel since an Iranian missile attack October 1st, the killings of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza last week, and Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon last month. State Department spokesman Vedant Patel says there could be an opening for diplomacy, particularly in Gaza.
We feel strongly that there is an opportunity to move the ball forward as it relates to getting a ceasefire accomplished.
And a deal to get hostages out of Gaza, including some Americans. The U.S. painted Sinwar as the main obstacle to that, but Brian Katulis of the Middle East Institute says it was never that clear-cut, and Blinken has work to do.
The stakes are high, but the odds of success are low, which makes it like a lot of his previous trips.
Blinken has tried on numerous trips to move ceasefire talks forward and to push Israel to allow more aid into Gaza, while some hope that Israel will change its approach now that it has killed Sinwar, one of its key war goals. Katula says many in the region fear the opposite.
I think that's the fear of many of the hostage families right now, is that the basic disarray of Hamas, but also this sort of creation of a Mogadishu on the Mediterranean that is a consequence of Israel's prosecution of this war without having a clear endgame in mind, could actually complicate the efforts of trying to achieve a diplomatic resolution here.
Then there's Israel's war to the north, where it is trying to push the militant group Hezbollah back from the border with Lebanon. Some hawkish voices in the U.S. and in Israel see this as a time to press Israel's advantage against Iranian proxies in the Middle East. That worries Matt Duss, a former foreign policy advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders.
There are people in the Biden administration who are buying this. They see, you know, what is happening in Gaza, what is happening in Lebanon, possible strikes elsewhere in the region, including in Iran, as a way to essentially reshuffle the regional security deck.
All the talk about reshaping the Middle East reminds him of the things the Bush administration would say during the last Israel-Hezbollah war in Lebanon.
And we have seen historically that this kind of hubris and overreach does not deliver peace. It does not deliver stability. It has a whole set of unintended consequences that may not happen right now, but they will come.
Duss, who's with the Center for International Policy, is a critic of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, saying the Israeli leader has prioritized his own political power rather than looking for ways to end the war. So Duss does not have high hopes for Secretary Blinken's trip.
I think the United States looks, you know, more powerless with every successive trip he takes there and comes back with nothing.
Blinken has meetings with Israeli officials on Tuesday and is expected to make other stops in the region this week. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Kansas City Chiefs place kicker Harrison Butker is back in national news, but not for his performance on the field. Earlier this year, he made comments that critics say were sexist and homophobic in a college graduation speech. And now he's founded a political action committee to get conservative Christians out to vote. Butker is white, and for some NFL watchers, he seems to be getting a lot more leeway than, say, Colin Kaepernick, whose career ended when he protested the country's racism.
Dave Zirin has been covering this. He's the sports editor at The Nation magazine. Dave, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Dave, I want to start, if we can, by taking a look back to this commencement speech that Harrison Butker gave that drew a whole lot of attention. He was speaking at Benedictine College, which is a small Catholic school in the state of Kansas. Can you just start by reminding us briefly what he said there?
Harrison Butker, as he put it, very intentionally decided to wage an argument. And that argument was in the name of his form of very traditional Catholicism that involves women being in a submissive position to men, women seeing themselves as a homemaker and as a mother, and frankly, as a breeder of more children, to be the ultimate role for women in society. And of course, a lot of this is based around a very heteronormative view of what it means to be a woman, reflected in Butker's other comments that were deemed very homophobic.
Right. And so now he's launched this political action committee. It's called Upright PAC. And according to its website, this PAC will, quote, reclaim the traditional values that have made this country great. And he wants to mobilize Christian voters with this effort. He's endorsed and been out campaigning with Missouri's Republican Senator Josh Hawley. How unusual is it to see an NFL player doing what Butker's doing here, going out, launching a PAC, fundraising, campaigning with an active political candidate? Do we see this often?
We definitely don't see it often in terms of funding a PAC and trying to be a power player behind the scenes. We've certainly seen many NFL players, more than the listener might think, leave the National Football League and go directly into a career in politics as a congressperson, mostly Republican, but not exclusively Republican. What makes Butker, though, particularly unusual, though, is less about the super PAC and more about the kind of political Christianity that's very different from what we have seen as quote unquote mainstream, and frankly represents the shift to the right that we've seen in the GOP under the leadership of Donald Trump.
The NFL has a massive fan base, and it's one that we know is politically diverse. Do you think that we are going to see more players from across the ideological spectrum stepping out in the way that Harrison Butker did? If we flip the script to next season, do you think there's a chance we see players who are liberal-leaning or left-leaning coming out, creating political action committees, stumping on supportive candidates in the way that Butker is this season?
I have to say, I do not think we're going to see that across the political spectrum in the National Football League, precisely because Colin Kaepernick and his teammate Eric Reed really are seen to have paid for their activism on the left side of the spectrum with their jobs. And so that acts as a ghost story among NFL players, haunting them to say, you better not step out of line or they will end your future in this league.
Last thing, Dave, I do feel the need to ask here, how much of this is about the politics at play and how much of it, if any of it, do you think is about race?
It's very difficult, particularly in this election season, to separate questions of racism and politics. And NFL owners, none of whom are Black, are exercising a power over Black players that is very dictatorial and very top-down. So it's absolutely about race, because they're trying to give Harrison Butker a platform so he can actually be up high as a political figure, while they're trying to push players like Colin Kaepernick down low and telling them to just shut up and play.
We've been talking with Dave Zirin. He's sports editor at The Nation magazine. Dave, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. The Beltrami County Historical Society hosts an afternoon with founding members of the band Podipto Saturday, October 26th at 2 o'clock at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. Tickets available at beltramihistory.org. Now it's time for the Up North Report here on KAXE KBXE.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has confirmed the presence of zebra mussels in Potato Lake near Park Rapids. A lake property owner contacted the DNR after a service provider found a zebra mussel on a boat lift they were removing for the season. DNR and Hubbard County staff and Potato Lake Association members found five more zebra mussels at the location and two more about 2.5 miles away. Several new zebra mussel confirmations in Minnesota lakes in recent years were initially reported by property owners and lake service providers who were removing docks, boats, or boat lifts at the end of the season. Political mailers sent to residents of House District 3A accused DFL candidate Harley Droba of voting to raise taxes on Social Security benefits, favoring water pollution, and supporting a, quote, radical open borders agenda. The Timberjay reports Droba's only political experience are his last 4 years as mayor of International Falls. The Republican Party of Minnesota and two right-wing political action committees are behind the mailings. The mailer accusing Droba of voting for higher taxes on Social Security benefits was paid for by the Republican Party. The others were paid for by the PACs, which don't list their donors. The Timberjay says the outside money pouring into the race has erased Droba's substantial fundraising advantage over Republican incumbent Roger Scraba. According to the most recent fundraising reports, Droba has raised more than twice as much money as Scraba. In other political news, an administrative law judge has dismissed an election complaint against State Representative Josh Heintzman lodged by his opponent, Troy Scheffler. Heintzman, who is a Republican from Nisswa, faces independent candidate Scheffler and DFLer Emily LeClaire in the upcoming election. Scheffler's complaint alleged that Heintzman broke the law by, quote, indirectly threatening Pequot Lakes Police Chief Mike Davis with losing his job if he didn't withdraw support of Scheffler's candidacy. Davis had signed a petition that ultimately allowed Scheffler's name to be on the ballot as an independent. The judge's ruling says the complaint did not provide sufficient facts to show that Heintzman's actions amounted to coercion. In June, Davis attempted to serve a lawsuit to Heintzman on behalf of Matthew Zinda, a Republican who challenged the incumbent in the primary. Heintzman questioned whether the chief had the authority to serve civil papers outside of the city of Pequot Lakes. He also asked Davis if his outreach was as a supporter of Scheffler, who Heintzman characterized as a friend to primary opponent Zinda. Heintzman contacted both the Pequot Lakes mayor and the head of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association about the matter. Davis testified that he felt anxious and intimidated by Heintzman's statements and actions, but he also said he was never told by anyone to vote a certain way or given the impression he would be fired. While dismissing the complaint, the judge opined that Heintzman's actions were out of proportion and that the, quote, number and nature of calls was perhaps more than was prudent for an elected official. Families in need of emergency housing in the city of Virginia now have greater access with the completion of a new facility. Range Transitional Housing celebrated the grand opening of the $2.2 million space last week. The building includes two adjoining houses, and each house will include both a three-bedroom and a two-bedroom apartment. Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation supported the project with a $400,000 community infrastructure grant to the city of Virginia. Range Transitional Housing is a nonprofit organization that has been serving homeless individuals and families in northern St. Louis County since 1993. The need for emergency housing in St. Louis County has always far exceeded the current capacity, according to the IRRR. The Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency's emergency shelters turn away nearly 1,000 homeless individuals every year. Games under the Friday night lights and meets in the autumn air are nearly over as the fall sports season wraps up. But as October approaches its end, playoff season for high school athletics is just kicking off. Visit KAXE.org to see our roundup of the dates and locations of the Minnesota State High School League's state tournaments, as well as which teams and students from the Northland have qualified. As more student athletes run, pass, and swim their hearts out for a chance to make it to state, we'll update our list so you know who you can root for in the postseason. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Former President Donald Trump loves attention from the press, but he also expresses a lot of contempt toward the press, as he did during a recent interview with Bloomberg News.
What is the Wall Street Journal? They've been wrong about everything. So have you, by the way.
On the campaign trail, Trump has suggested that if he regains the White House, he will exact vengeance on news outlets that anger him, a stark violation of First Amendment principles. NPR's David Folkenflik reports that the comments come at a time of heightened concern about Trump's more autocratic impulses.
It's not subtle, it's not isolated, it's not off the cuff. Last year, Trump called for NBC to lose its license over its coverage of criminal charges he's facing. In August, after the debate with Vice President Kamala Harris, it was ABC's turn.
I think ABC took a big hit last night.
The network's moderators had fact-checked Trump several times. He popped up on Fox and Friends with a warning for ABC.
I mean, to be honest, they're a news organization. They have to be licensed to do it. They ought to take away their license for the way they did that.
That's actually not quite how it works. But this month, he's been back at it, slamming CBS over the vice presidential debate and the network's interview of Harris. Here Trump was in Colorado.
Think of this. So CBS gets a license, and the license is based on honesty. I think they have to take their license away. I do.
Press advocates say Trump has fueled a climate hostile to independent reporting. A new survey of hundreds of journalists by the International Women's Media Foundation finds about a third say they have faced or been threatened with physical violence on the job, especially at Trump campaign rallies. A spokeswoman for the Republican National Committee says, quote, President Trump was a champion for free speech. Everyone was safer under President Trump, including journalists. Even so, Trump has repeatedly pledged to jail reporters if they don't identify confidential sources.
And when this person realizes that he is going to be the bride of another prisoner very shortly, he will say, I'd very much like to tell you exactly who that leaker it was Bill.
This at a Texas rally 2 years ago, and Trump said, not just the reporters.
And the publisher, too, or the top editors.
At the New York Times, leaders are girding for what might ensue if Trump wins. Here's executive editor Joseph Kahn.
The publisher devoted a team of people and a significant effort to looking at the ways in which the rule of law, protections for the press could be worn away by either authoritarian leaders or by populist leaders who rally their supporters against independent media.
Kahn spoke recently with NPR's Steve Inskeep.
And we shouldn't pretend that they're only vulnerable in a place like Hungary or Turkey. They are also vulnerable here.
As president, Trump aided allies such as Fox News founder Rupert Murdoch, and he tried to punish critical outlets. His administration sought to block the takeover of CNN's parent company and tried to deny a cloud computing contract for Amazon, founded by Washington Post owner Jeff Bezos. So let's return to the question of those broadcast licenses Trump says he wants to take away. Jessica Rosenworcel is the chairwoman of the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, it speaks directly to the First Amendment. And the First Amendment is a cornerstone of our democracy.
To be clear, the networks aren't licensed at all. Local TV and radio stations are, by the FCC, to use the public airwaves. The three big broadcast networks' parent companies own about 80 stations among them. Each station is a profit center and therefore a pressure point for those networks. Rosenworcel tells me any such pressure endangers the media's free speech rights.
While the FCC has authority to provide licenses for television and radio, it is pretty fundamental that we do not take them away because a political candidate disagrees with or dislikes any kind of content or coverage.
The FCC was set up 90 years ago as a semi-autonomous agency. While Rosenworcel was appointed chairwoman by President Biden, she is not subject to his directive. Last year, Trump posted a video promising to bring the agency under full White House control.
I will bring the independent regulatory agencies such as the FCC and the FTC back under presidential authority as the Constitution demands.
That claim about constitutional authority is highly contentious.
These agencies do not get to become a fourth branch of government, issuing rules and edicts all by themselves, and that's what they've been doing.
It's the frequency of these attacks on the First Amendment that strikes me most.
Once again, FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel.
We can't let this be normal. If you want to maintain a constitutional democracy, you have to speak up for it.
Her term is up in June. Her successor will be appointed by the next president. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
In Cuba, lights are starting to come back on 4 days into a nationwide blackout. This darkness fell during the country's worst economic crisis in decades. Emily Green reports.
Life in Cuba is hard, really hard. Since the beginning of the year, residents have endured rolling blackouts that often last 8 hours a day. Public transportation was slashed because there wasn't enough fuel to run the buses. The country's communist government started limiting allocations of bread only to children and pregnant women. And then came Friday, when the entire country went dark after the electrical grid collapsed. We are living a nightmare. It's like a horror movie, says Claribel, a mother and grandmother living in Santiago de Cuba, the country's second largest city. NPR is withholding the full names of the Cubans interviewed for the story because of the risk of retaliation from the government. Claribel's husband had to scavenge for coal so that she could cook the chicken she had in the refrigerator before it spoiled. She turned it into a soup she hopes will last several days. What are we going to do? We'll die of hunger. We have to invent something, she says. In the capital of Havana, these residents gathered on the streets and played dominoes. School has been canceled through Wednesday, and Havana's international airport has been operating on an emergency basis only. Noemi, a woman in her 20s, spent Sunday night outside. It's horrible. So many hours in darkness, she says. You can't protest, whistle, or even ask questions because you will be imprisoned, she says. Still, some bold residents clanged on pots in protest over the multi-day power outage.
Nunca la revolución va a tolerar este tipo.
Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel warned the government won't tolerate dissidents or vandalism.
Y que todos serán procesados como corresponde con el rigor que contemplan las leyes revolucionarias.
Everyone will be processed rigorously under our revolutionary laws, he said in a televised address. The Cuban government blames its problems on a decades-old U.S. embargo that has made it very difficult for the island to purchase fuel and food. By Monday morning, lights had started to flicker on in Havana, but few expected it to last. With gas scarce, people were cooking on wood stoves.
La situación aquí en Cuba en este momento es crítica.
The situation here in Cuba is dire, says Manuel, a resident of Havana who works as a security guard.
No solamente con la luz.
Not just because of the blackouts, but everything. Even when one has money to buy food, there isn't any to be found, he says. Manuel's entire family has fled Cuba in recent years and migrated to the U.S. His mom, brother, uncles, and cousins. He and his wife are also trying to leave, joining the biggest mass exodus in Cuba's history. For NPR News, I'm Emily Green in Mexico City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Companies in many major cities in the U.S. are offering bike sharing, car sharing, scooter sharing. Now, a company has brought the concept of umbrella sharing to New York City. Reporter Jeff London was curious to see how it worked.
Who hasn't lost or forgotten an umbrella? On a rainy Saturday afternoon, I made my way to the lobby of an apartment building in downtown Brooklyn, which had an umbrella-sharing machine right by the double doors, and met one of the residents, Josh Tompkins, who was picking up an umbrella.
It's in the building. I don't have an umbrella myself, and it's super convenient.
He showed me how to use the app.
Yeah, you scan the QR code, and it gives you the umbrella to pick. You pick it. Never had an issue with the umbrella. And you get to go.
The machines and umbrellas come from a company called Rentbrella, based in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Co-founder Freddy Marcos says his business partner got caught in the rain as he was exiting the subway and asked,
"So why not share umbrellas the same way you share bikes, cars, houses?" So then we started developing the whole concept of umbrella sharing, and we understood that everyone hates to carry an umbrella, especially when it's not raining.
Although the app asks people to put in credit card information, Freddy Marcos says the service is free.
When it's raining, you always have 24 hours free each time you get an umbrella. If you get an umbrella today, you return it tomorrow, it's free.
The app has a map of locations and you can return your umbrella anywhere. And if you don't return it in the allotted time, you get charged $2 a day until you hit $16, at which point you own the umbrella. So how does this little $8 million startup company make its money? Two ways, says Freddy Marcos. The first is advertising. In Sao Paulo, they carry the branding of a major health insurance company on their umbrellas. The second is getting companies to license the service in their buildings.
So they pay a fee to have the service for their visitors, for their tenants, for their users.
In New York, you can pick up umbrellas in the lobbies of hotels, office and apartment buildings, as well as entrances to garages. And on rainy days, the 100 umbrellas in the custom-made machines can disappear quickly, says Marcos. That's why he plans to add more machines in New York. He hopes to work out a deal to put them in the subway. And he wants to bring Rentbrella to other cities, which have a lot of foot traffic, a lot of rain, like Seattle, and a lot of companies willing to sponsor the service.
We think it's a matter of time for us to conquer the whole world.
But first, the company needs to conquer New York, one customer at a time. Like Josh Tompkins, who pulled out a big purple umbrella and was ready to walk out in the rain.
Boom, easy enough.
He says he'll be using it again. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in rainy Brooklyn.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. It's 5:48. KAXE cares about keeping Northern Minnesota communities informed. Do you know who is on the ballot at your voting place? Go to KAXE.org and check out our extensive Northern Minnesota election guide and local election coverage. Then click on the donate button to help us keep you ready for Election Day and all year long. The Set List is our weekly primer on live music, curated by KXE's music team. The Set List spotlights shows at area venues. KXE.org, click Live Music under Local Events. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu is available at rapidsbrewingco.com. The Grand Rapids Area Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness offers a Hope for Recovery workshop Saturday, October 26th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Woodland Bank Community Room. Learn about a variety of mental illnesses, crisis management, suicide prevention, and more. It's designed for loved ones of those living with a mental illness. Programming is supported by Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 24th at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. And we receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. Northern Lights Community School in Warba has a kids' Halloween carnival Saturday, October 26th from 1 to 3 with games, activities, and candy. Proceeds support student programs.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Native voters living on tribal land often face barriers to voting. In Nevada, those Native voters can now cast a ballot online. Nevada Public Radio's Paul Boger reports.
Indigenous voters have historically turned out to vote at much lower rates than white voters. One reason is that tribal communities have faced historical and geographic obstacles to casting a ballot, including a lack of polling locations and unreliable mail service.
One of the day-to-day challenges that you come to accept.
That's Brian Mason, chairman of the Shoshone Paiute Tribes of the Duck Valley Reservation, which straddles the Nevada-Idaho state line. In previous elections, anyone who wanted to vote in person had to drive 2 hours away on election day. Mason says a lot of people didn't get a chance to vote.
You know, in the past, it's been, well, if you couldn't make it to Elko, then you just didn't make it to Elko.
This year, voters living on the Duck Valley Reservation or any of the other 27 federally recognized tribal communities in the state can vote online using what's called the e-system, available through the Nevada Secretary of State's website. The state developed it in 2014 to allow members of the armed forces overseas and others to cast absentee ballots online.
I think it's great to see that this voting tool is being expanded to our people.
Matilda Miller is with Native Voters Alliance of Nevada, one of the organizations that push for the expansion. She says ease, along with voting by mail, allows Native voters in the state to have their voices heard like never before.
It's allowing people who have the means and the infrastructure to actually cast your vote. I'm excited about it.
However, there are concerns about the security of voting online. In 2022, a group of experts gathered by UC Berkeley warned it's infeasible to say internet ballots are 100% safe using current cybersecurity standards. But Secretary of State Cisco Aguilar says his office took steps to ensure the system is as secure as possible.
We built it here in Nevada with our own team, with careful understanding of the security issues and the security challenges. You know, security is our number one priority with the e-system. We want to ensure that every ballot that's cast gets counted and that it's being done by an eligible Nevada voter.
For the Native Voters Alliance in Nevada, those concerns are part of an effort to continue disenfranchising Native voters. Still, online voting will not improve turnout among Native voters overnight, mainly because the people who already lack reliable mail service also lack broadband. For NPR News, I'm Paul Boger in Reno, Nevada.
An unconventional way of practicing medicine has been catching on lately. It's called street medicine because medical professionals care for patients on the street, outside of traditional brick and mortar facilities. Practitioners and advocates say providing mental and physical health care for those who are unhoused is a key piece of the puzzle in mitigating homelessness. And the federal government recently made a small but significant change in order to better fund this kind of work. NPR's Katie Riddle has more.
Tents dot the sidewalk on a block that's a common gathering place for unhoused folks in Portland, Oregon. On this day, Lori Dolo Scott is part of the street medicine team working here. She watches a colleague of hers a few yards away. Her colleague is leaning over a man holding a clipboard.
So she's going to register him.
Registering him for the state's Medicaid program. Their organization is called Central City Concern. It's a nonprofit. Dolo Scott says this team has adapted to do this kind of work in all kinds of settings recently.
I can just do it anywhere. I can figure it out.
Is this an example of something that you couldn't, until recently, you could not do? Register someone on the sidewalk like that?
We could register them, but we couldn't bill for it.
They couldn't bill Oregon's Medicaid. That's the joint federal-state health insurance program for low-income people. Because the care took place outside a medical facility. That limited what they could provide. Now that's changed.
Which makes the feasibility of this type of work, of getting nearer to people, so much easier.
Before she worked with unhoused people, Dolo Scott worked in countries with disaster and refugee crises. Haiti, Kosovo, Iraq, Sri Lanka.
So I guess my comparison would be that it's harder to do it here in the States than it is to do it in a war zone because of the red tape. In the war zone, you're like, oh, you need help, I'm helping you. Right? Here it's like, you need help? Okay, let's talk about your registration. And that for some people, that becomes its own barrier.
The change to the federal Medicaid code went into effect about a year ago.
You know, street medicine is fairly new.
Brett Feldman is the director of the Street Medicine Program at the University of Southern California. He led an effort to petition Medicaid for this change. Feldman says it wasn't that Medicaid resisted funding this kind of work before, they just hadn't needed to.
I just don't think anybody had asked before that.
The number of teams has more than doubled in California in the last few years. Street medicine is coming to more and more states across the country.
And the care we provide is more than just what you would expect in an office visit, even if that office is under the bridge. So we dispense medications, draw labs. A lot of us do ultrasound and EKGs.
A fundamental part of working with this population is treating behavioral health disorders. With a shortage of psychiatrists, says Feldman, people who practice primary care, like him, have learned how to deliver treatments like antipsychotics.
I mean, we can give one injection. It can last a month or more. They're never lost or stolen or degraded by the elements, which have been just a game changer on the street.
Getting to that point where a patient will trust a doctor enough to allow them to inject an antipsychotic or talk to them about treatment for substance use disorder, that takes time. Back in Portland, outreach worker Laurel Sanford approaches a group of people gathered together in the parking lot. She hands out little things, water, stickers.
Yeah. You want some stickers?
These are initial offerings to build relationships.
Yeah.
Is that right?
For sure. Yeah.
One woman says she needs help. Sanford takes her over to the van where they have medical supplies.
So I'm trying to get her hooked up with our navigation team because she is telling us she's pregnant.
This population has high levels of trauma. They often resist treatment at first.
I think that it's so intense now with the kinds of problems that people have, mental health problems, drug problems.
For Sanford, this work became personal a few years ago.
My son and his friends kind of got involved really in the drug culture.
She says her son is in recovery now. He's been living with her. But there were days when she knew he was out here too.
Wow, you would go look for your son and his friends?
I tried not to, but, you know, every once in a while, they would just turn up in the churn of people.
As a parent, that just, it's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was rough. It was really rough. But, you know, I was always happy when I saw them because that meant they were still alive.
The members of the street medicine team say there's no silver bullet for solving these kinds of behavioral problems. It will take a lot of strategies deployed together to make a big difference, including one small change in Medicaid policy. Katie Riddle, NPR News, Portland, Oregon.
And one more thing to let you know, you can now enjoy the Consider This newsletter. We still help you break down a major story of the day, but you'll also get to know our producers, our hosts, and some moments of joy from the All Things Consider team. Just sign up at npr.org/consider this newsletter. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is only in theaters on Friday, November 1st. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXC.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support comes from Sanford Bemidji's Doc Talk series, Dr. Kayla Scheinheit and clinical counselor Ashla McMartin will provide free information about depression on Thursday, October 24th at 5:30 p.m. Learn more and register at 218-333-5862. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, slight chance for showers in northwest Minnesota,